Welcome to Terragrams. Hi, I'm Craig Verzone, and I'll be your host for the 31st Dispatch of Terragrams. Terragrams has reached a critical impasse and is in need of assistance. To continue, Terragrams must rely on contributions from listeners like you. Your support will assure that you, your colleagues, studio, faculty body, students, and classmates can continue to benefit from our growing and open archive as well as all of our forthcoming conversations. All donations count. Please help. Visit our website at terragrams.com for more information. Today in Dispatch 31, we are joined by Casey Brown. Casey Brown is currently an assistant professor of landscape architecture at Clemson University and a principal researcher with PREX, an organization embedded within the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. He is the 2010-2011 recipient of the Rome Prize in Landscape Architecture and has recently followed research concerning the U.S.-Mexico border, North American urbanization trends, and large-scale mining and extraction sites. In Terragrams Dispatch 31, Brown shares his thoughts regarding his work methods for his research in Rome, as well as for entities as diverse as Toyota, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the U.S. Department of Defense, all of which, in Brown's words, document herd swarm behavior, cascading effects, negative positive externalities, and low probability, high impact events. Terragrams is very happy to welcome Casey Brown.
Case, welcome to Terragrams.
Thank you.
You analyze and represent radical collective behavior points that push landscape towards environmental tipping points. The environmental tipping points are described in your work from the conditioned sprawl of speculative land investment in your Rome Prize work here to the unintended or contradictory consequences of cultural, legislative, and militaristic action along the U.S.-Mexico border, work that you did with the Institute for Wishful Thinking. These two projects have a broad range depending on the context. How do you characterize the environmental tipping point?
Well, it all derives from this concept of cascades, this idea that a series of rational steps or rational behaviors in collective may end up producing an irrational result. So, for example, fish balls in the ocean exhibit kind of complex behavior where they shape themselves like a large fish as a whole to avoid a predator or to scare off a predator. But that is derived solely from a series of individual behaviors that are just follow the fish that's beside me and adjust my direction based on theirs. So those simple steps can create a complex behavior. Now, sometimes that can go awry, it can go wrong. And of course, I'm not the first one to speculate on why that is, but some scientists have indicated that it can go wrong if every individual behavior is not independently determined. In other words, there's communication. So others know what others are doing at a distance. And that may be what is happening with real estate, for example. Perhaps everyone gets involved because they know that so-and-so is getting rich off of it. And once everyone achieves this kind of excitement in the collective behavior, it goes too high and assets become way vastly overvalued. At that point, the first person or the first group to realize that that behavior is no longer sustainable triggers a crash. And that's the tipping point itself.
And what kind of implications does any of this have on landscape?
Well, sadly, I think many of our landscapes today, especially real estate investment, are determined solely based on the riches and the value increase of these assets. So in other words, they're not built for any particular cultural benefit. They're not built necessarily even for amenity value. They're instead built for someone, somewhere, to make money, either in a fund or individually. Because of that scenario, I feel like we need to become much more intelligent about the economics that determine the landscapes that get built, determine the landscapes that get developed, determine the landscapes that get altered in the larger sense. This applies to mining as well. because of the increase in copper and gold price currently, you know, basic commodities, either because China's increasing its economy or because we think gold is a great place to hold our real underlying value, new mines are built all over the world. And they're built rapidly to benefit from this price increase. And those, they're not necessarily built for economic need. They're built simply because of the value increase, the commodity price increases. So I think we as designers or anyone who interacts with large-scale landscape, we need to become more intelligent about the forces that are driving those, because they're at a distance, sometimes in time, but definitely a distance in space.
Do you think we have any way of affecting them? Or do we just need to hone our way of reacting to them?
I think both. I think that we have to increase our knowledge base first, because that just simply hasn't been done. The kind of basic transfer of knowledge between economists, ecologists, and the actual businessmen in, making the decisions for the change. A perfect example is Toyota came to us, PREX, the organization I work with, to assess the future of North American urbanization. That's a corporation coming to landscape architects to understand the future environment that they may interact with, both as a market, of course, they're a company there, they intend to make money, but also as an attempt to affect the sort of environmental benefit of the product in the future, to kind of preempt the environment.
And in this case, the project with Toyota, what are you attempting to measure or map in order to give them a visualization of the future of urbanization? It seems limitless. Where do you start?
It is relatively limitless. We start essentially with whatever database can cover the entire continental U.S. And we're lucky that the U.S. has a decent data infrastructure. I mean, it has its problems, and I can get to that, but we can kind of combine the projections of each metropolitan area with the possible projections of economy to kind of relate the demographics to the land being built. Those projections are enforced by the federal government under the Clean Air Act. Each city must plan to accommodate its future transportation needs. And so it's a kind of hijacking of that data to then determine the best we can with the best data we have. How big, how much, how many, the basic parameters of future urbanization.
And what type of data sets are you overlaying?
So we certainly like to look at your basic VMT, VHT. It's vehicle miles traveled or vehicle hours traveled. It's the common measurement in transportation statistics for the basic raw demand on our roads.
This is all data-based.
Exactly. Very much so. Those then interact with the land being built, both for housing, of course, but also for the civic and cultural amenities that are associated with it, whether it be retail, schools, hospitals, etc. And we know that the story of the past 50 years of suburbanization, and that kind of link between the value of land the further you get from the city. It's far easier to build 30 miles from a city than it is near downtown. And so until those pressures are changed, it's likely to continue the onslaught of exterior urbanization outside this inner city.
And what kind of time frame do you inject into your equations?
They all hover around 30 years. You know, some 20, some 40, but it's pretty hard.
Is this based on the data that's available?
It is based on the data that's available, primarily related to demographics. That tends to be your base form of projection. How many people will there be? And thus you associate the types of demand on the other systems.
Where are you in the research? What kind of results are you starting to produce?
We are roughly in the middle of that project. We have applied it to several large urban areas, such as Atlanta and Denver, you know, large growing cities that have a steady economy, as well as
selected
kind of national
by you or by Toyota?
Selected by both of us through a strict series of criteria to attempt to not bias the study too much. You know, an average city and then a far-growing city. So we have both covered. What's left is declining cities and so forth.
Are there any trends, any new trends that you're starting to see?
They are. We're starting to tease out this idea of inter-suburban travel, that in fact, much of the travel going on in large metropolitan areas, so, you know, the Ring Road and even outside of it, the exurban area, the large amount of the travel is between suburbs, and we don't really have a transportation system that is designed to handle that. The interstate system is to travel between metropolitan areas, between large cities, or perhaps around the city, but not between suburbs.
And is this a surprise?
It's not a surprise, but it's a surprise at the sheer scale of it. Because much of the theory, much of the kind of impetus in American planning is largely to design more and more capacity to get between the center city and the external environments. But it may be that the majority of travel is between the exterior environments, and that the center city is obsolete on those scales.
Where does it put the center city in the study, and how do you relate to this? It's not bipolar, but this division in populations and energies being consumed.
It's tough to say, but that's the kind of approach that we bring. That's a bit different. Is we're not coming with really an a priori theory of whether the center city is valued or not. We simply look at the data and who stands up as a larger capacity, a larger demand. And currently, that's the external environment. Little attention's been paid to it, so now we're going to try to shower it with some attention to understand how it's working, and to also apply what future infrastructure could accommodate the need, or what's missing in the economic equation to make that transportation more efficient, less environmentally damaging, et cetera.
You're not going to be pushing any anti-suburban agenda subversively?
Unlikely, no. We'll let the numbers speak.
Why not? Okay. What's the impetus of Toyota to launch a study like this? What do they aim to get out of it?
I think Toyota, much like anyone who interacts on these kind of large-scale economic urban environments, is they're unsure. You know, there's large polarized talk. On the one hand, the kind of libertarian, you know, we'll build where we want, how we want, etc. And on the other hand, the kind of planner-centric design that implies that the center city is the most important thing. We need to get dense around it, and we need to apply all principles we can to achieve that goal. But the problem is the reality is definitely somewhere in between and something much more complex. And so I think Toyota did its own study and couldn't find much clarity. They just found these polarities. And so they came to us to try to tease it out a bit more neutrally.
Do you have any fears that your results may just justify the suburban condition and may actually fuel Toyota towards a marketing campaign that will target the sector?
It's always possible. We can't control what they do with the data. But what we can do, it's much better to be involved in the conversation than entirely external to it. And so that's why we decided to work with them as much as we can to inform their decisions.
In this study, do you see any environmental tipping points?
Very much so. I mean, of course, you have an issue of resource efficiency. Essentially, there's this ironic condition that happens. It's called Jevons paradox, whereby the more efficient you become at consuming a particular resource, instead of using less of it, use more of it. We expanded it with coal, same thing with electricity, et cetera. And so we think that there's some very strange counterarguments that happen whereby, let's say we make an entire electric car fleet, which sounds good on the surface because we're not using gas and oil. However, currently electricity is primarily supplied by coal. So it's basically coal-burning cars.
Transfer of carbon resource.
Precisely. Furthermore, what if the only thing that keeps people from driving even further than they do already is actually the guilt that they feel of using too much carbon, using too much resources? If you use electric cars and you somehow supply that renewably, then perhaps they live even further out and develop even more undeveloped areas. None of us know where any of those things are going, but to kind of get ahead of them and propose them as a possibility to begin getting the political apparatus to get their head around it is what we're trying to do.
Is there any way of overlaying or superimposing parallel study on renewable energy so that the education that's happening runs side and side with some implied solution or some set of ramifications?
I think that's precisely what we're trying to do in the next phase.
Yeah. And who's going to fund that study?
We'll see.
Do you think that's still a part of the Toyota study, or do you think
it very well could be, as well as in partnership with others.
Mm-hmm. And this is with your the organization PREX.
PREX, yes.
Tell us about PREX. How is it structured? When did it start? When did you jump in?
PREX started in the early 2000s, founded absolutely by the director, Alan Berger, a well-known landscape architect and a great colleague of mine. It's his baby, and he founded it as a kind of attempt to kind of get at these difficult questions, originally largely focused around mining landscapes and the fact that nobody was paying attention to them, yet there's a vast inventory of them that exist already as abandoned mines that nobody's treated, as well as there'll be future mining landscapes as we continue to consume electronics, etc. So he set up this organization to kind of liaison in between the design world and the pure business world. And it grew very rapidly, very quickly, and I teamed up with Alan while I was at the GSD at Harvard University, and he was teaching there. And Drawscape was sort of the main publication after the mining landscapes, and so it began to deal with urban landscapes. That's where Toyota found us, and they found Drawscape to be a kind of a forward-looking survey of urban landscapes, and they wanted to interact with us on that topic. There are many trails within PREX that work just like that, where we identify an issue, we begin writing about it, researching it, diagramming it, illustrating it, and trying to envision it in ways that other people haven't seen. You know, it's various kind of tentacles that tear out into the economic or ecological landscape. And then, ideally, people like Toyota or other foundations then come to us to fund a project that's based on that to get more sort of verifiable results on it.
Internally, do you talk about your own tipping points relative to your clients and their needs and their ultimate agenda versus your own pedagogic beliefs? And where does your work, or where does the neutrality of your work obtain its limits?
Yeah. Well, certainly there's no such thing as an unbiased view. Essentially, we're limited by the data that we have that's been collected, which can be entirely biased based on its collection method, for example. We always try to verify what we do by a few different angles. So we'll do a survey of kind of popular media. We'll do a survey of academic literature. And then we'll also do our own survey of raw data that we can interact with anew. And so we kind of triangulate our way through that and attempt for the most neutral kind of unbiased view that can allow. Naturally, we're always biased toward the ecological world and the need to kind of work with life and life systems. We know they're being affected. And so we're trying to determine both how they're being affected with what forces, but we're also attempting to design a world that can increase both economic systems as well as life systems, because they're always put in opposition to each other. So of course we have, or I should say I have that agenda always behind what I do, but I attempt to first see what the forces are at play so that I can neutrally interact with them then for a better goal.
Give me an example of increased economic profitability plus life system development.
Yeah. Well, for example, let's talk about the border landscape. And so on the U.S.-Mexico border, we have massive delays of the trade that tries to cross the border because of the security apparatus. Naturally, everything has to be scanned and verified, sourced, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That slows down the trade systems. And it's primarily because we've collapsed the security apparatus with the economic apparatus. And there's no need to do that. And what I've suggested is that we severely invest in infrastructure near urban areas for that trade apparatus, and thereby, as well as the immigration apparatus working with that infrastructure, thereby freeing the landscape that's currently being used and trampled on by both immigrants and their border patrol to kind of handle the security situation and sort of separate those two so that immigrants are currently being diverted around the areas because the security is strong near the urban areas. That's the kind of mixture that is very hard to tease apart. And sadly, I think that we haven't achieved that goal very well, either on the security level, on the economic level, or on the ecological level. So if we had a new infrastructure that could handle immigration as well as trade near the urban areas, then the more remote sectors of the border would no longer be used by immigrants and drug trafficking.
Eagle.
You are listening to Terragrams, and our guest is Casey Brown, Assistant Professor of Landscape Architecture at Clemson University, Principal Researcher with PREX, and the 2010-2011 recipient of the American Academy of Rome Prize in Landscape Architecture.
This kind of study, this kind of thinking, is far away from traditional practice of landscape architecture. Where do you position yourself between role of researcher, designer, interlocutor, scientist?
Well, you know, coming out of school, I didn't find the practice of landscape architecture to be kind of fruitful or engaging very much. I didn't find any project that seemed to be large enough to have a true impact.
Coming out of graduate school.
So I began to just imagine a different path and approach the projects that I felt that we needed to be working on. And at this point, I think that I've come up with this idea of meta-landscape, that we shouldn't necessarily all be interacting on the site individual component level of landscape, the trees, the people, the pedestrian paths, etc. But some of us should be looking at the large-scale meta-landscape forces that interact in an entirely different way. They work on different principles, and you have to look at them with a different filter. I call it a macroscope, which others have used, of course, scientists primarily. And it literally, I like to think of it literally working like a microscope, but in an inverted fashion. In other words, you can't see the same things until you look through that view. So it's larger scale patterns, larger scale trends, large forces that you're interacting with. And a great example, in my opinion, is I did this sort of survey of borders around the world to try to contextualize the U.S.-Mexico border issue. And almost everywhere that has a border conflict of some sort with immigration, drugs, weapons, etc., is a place where the two economic parameters per capita are vastly different. So there's this kind of gradient across the border that almost pushes immigration to happen, no matter what. So until we interact with that economic gradient, I don't understand how the border situation will be ameliorated. Israel-Palestine, U.S.-Mexico.
And does this kind of visualization propose any solutions or a path towards discussing some of the questions?
No, absolutely it does. I think probably the most advanced at this point is the border project, because I have begun to suggest through very innovative channels that the U.S.-Mexico border situation could be potentially resolved through a single move. And that would be that advanced militarization of the entire border.
What do you mean by advanced?
I mean, I say advanced because it's already militarized. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of embedded argument I put in there because people are quite concerned about that. National Guard is already deployed there. The Border Patrol is extensively deployed. The Mexican Army is deployed, et cetera, et cetera. It's dangerous. The public is already incapable of or prohibited from accessing many border parks, et cetera, et cetera. And so what I've suggested is advance the militarization, provide a kind of temporary exclusion zone where our military actually uses these zones, but also provides the security apparatus, which is far better funded through the Department of Defense than it is through the national park system, which is the way it currently is handled.
So the Department of Defense has no right to be within these areas currently?
Currently, no, only near a few bases and a few select places.
And do you imagine training happening?
I think training can and should happen because that provides this great alternative effect. They're called positive dividends of the law of unintended consequences. So in other words, you make a big change and it makes unintended consequences, and they can be positive or negative. Well, it turns out most military installations eventually become wilderness preserves simply through the exclusion of people in their buffer. And so that's why I've suggested that militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border could provide a temporary exclusion zone that would allow kind of biological productivity to reestablish itself, organisms to not be encumbered by the border wall itself, which is an insane policy that I have seen no proper justification for. It's a kind of like medieval border fortification of the country, as if it's a functional method in today's mobile world where you can go by so many methods. And so this is a positive dividend that kind of automatically is applied by simply excluding people and have the military there. Their training requires, you know, lack of noise, lack of not of light pollution, and other parameters, so that their training operations are actually like the conditions that they'll be working in. At current border military installations around the country, those conditions aren't true. They have light pollution. They have encroachment through development. So then those military installations could be freed up for other uses, regional parks, metropolitan parks, et cetera.
What kind of obstacles do the Secretary of Immigration and Secretary of Defense bring up in the conversation that you have with the two of them?
Well, I haven't had that conversation yet,
but
I can imagine. I can imagine extensive one. Of course, the overlay district would spring all kinds of kind of private property issues, as well as bureaucratic kind of fights between the departments. But the fact is, currently they don't talk. They haven't even imagined this scenario. So if they did sit down and talk and consider the fact that the national park system and especially the wildlife refuge system simply cannot handle the immigration, the security apparatus, the amount of drugs running through these areas that are automatically destroying the kind of a priori reason for being of the wildlife refuges and national parks.
Is the wildlife refuge department, are they ready to let go of all control mm-hmm. over these areas? Or do they have their own agenda of maintenance or oversight that would not marry well with the Defense Department?
They very much have their own agendas. However, significant parts of their budget are currently being consumed by security. And that's what's so ironic. And they can't handle it. I see no reason why they can't those agencies can't simultaneously operate the wildlife system outside of public access along with the Department of Defense.
Now, it's clear that wildlife refuge as a landscape typology is something that seems to marry well with landscape architecture. But immigration and defense don't seem to be topics that get much discussion. Mm-hmm. Which fields do you think we should be as landscape architects, becoming more interested in and should be more relevant towards landscape, especially landscape at this macro scale or the meta scale that you're talking about?
Well, we're in a very interesting time. I mean, there's theories that are now kind of attempting to kind of combine highly humanities-driven ideas with highly scientific principles. A great example is a guy named Jeffrey West at the Santa Fe Institute is analyzing how cities really may be able to operate like biological organisms, and that the scaling principles of an organism, population, colony may apply to a city as well. That is, for example, that it, as it gets bigger, it consumes more and more. And that's a kind of counterintuitive idea, but it seems to apply to the numbers. Another example is a new field called econophysics, where we're looking at the kind of physical limits of economic ideas and how perhaps physical predispositions that are true of matter all the way up to biological organisms apply to economic systems. There's a thing called co-movement. So when assets of various types, everything from oil to housing to other types of investment, copper, gold, all start to move together, meaning they all increase in value or they all decrease in value, that is considered now a kind of a dangerous alarm signal that something may be ready to crash because the financial system's far too interlinked. So it's like a physical property of matter as well.
And coming back to the profession of landscape architecture, are professionals ready to handle this kind of sophistication? Are we adept at understanding the sciences or bringing these knowledges together in order to propose new solutions or propose new ways to visualize the problems?
Well, let me answer that two ways. First of all, let's think about the start of the American branch of the profession with Frederick Law Olmsted, who was a scientific farmer, a publisher, a sanitary engineer, and that allowed him to operate projects that are far more complex than we, I think, conceive of today. Certainly there are a few exceptions that are doing very good work, but it's certainly exceptions and not the general rule. Oh, Frederick Law Olmsted is integral to both the national park system, the regional park system, metropolitan park system, and all that implies about the kind of scalar relationships between the Forest Service all the way down to your local community park that increases real estate value around it. That's an amazing effect, if you ask me. And we've lost a lot of that over the years as we've become more site-based, more interested in the kind of creative genius as if that can kind of solve the world's problems instead of a more data-driven, research-based theory and practice.
And how does this kind of data begin to drive some of the decisions that we need to make on a planning scale or even on a smaller site scale?
Well, first of all, it takes away religious tendencies in theory. So this kind of obsession with density, for example, or the kind of uber focus on form as a solution in the world. These things can be contextualized with data, I think, a bit better. That in fact, economics may be driving much of what's happening on a site, not the design, not the form. Or in the example of density, that denser areas, of course, price out so much of the populace that you're inevitably creating non-dense areas just by creating dense areas.
Wouldn't one be able to argue that the manipulation of your data sets and the form of visualization can push contrary agendas?
It certainly can. There's no such thing as information that can't be manipulated. So we don't remove the ability to tell lies with data. In fact, data is often used to kind of justify lies. However, once we interact with numbers, I think that we can greatly increase the kind of prestige and the ability of decision making within the profession on a larger scale. On a private site, there's no one but the private owner and his constituency that has to deal with the ramification of the project. So that can't be controlled. But when you're talking about effects that are larger than the site itself, which is true of any suburb, and it's true of any park, and it's true of any mine, then I think that that's where we as designers need to begin interacting with the forces that are at play to set that project forward, and the forces at play that determine what the project kind of becomes in its afterlife as well. And currently the profession is not set up to deal with that. But data wrangling is the future of most professions, if you ask me. And we both need to educate ourselves on statistics and the use of statistics, as well as integrate statisticians into our basic modus operandi as we develop sites and projects. It's a kind of reversal of the developed model over the past 100 years of client determines they want something done, designer then achieves that project for them, either through their own vision or through that client's vision. We try to think, and I try to think more carefully about what's a problem in the world that needs to be interacted with, and then begin to characterize it, formulate it, visualize it, and then find a client or attract a client to that project to then achieve it. It's a far more difficult model, and it's not for every project.
Would you say that it has limitations of scale, that it really is a macro or meta scale methodology, and it has no or has little influence over site-based projects? That it's really a planning apparatus?
I suppose that it has to start at the macro and meta scale, simply because those are the forces determining whether a small site happens or doesn't happen, as well as what will be in that site or not in that site. Whether the ecology of that small site will function or not is determined by large macro forces such as economy, climate change, weather systems, invasive movement of species, etc. So the small site is, for me, becomes a kind of manifestation of larger forces. And so we have to understand larger forces before we can even know what the small site will actually be.
But then to make the decisions on the small site, do you need to deploy a different working method?
I think that's where you can combine the working methods of the more traditional design, creatively based, more artistically inclined system, overlaid by the meta forces, the meta landscape forces that may be controlling at least some parameters of the site. So I think a two-tier system could work fine.
Some of your meta force modeling, does it include formal characteristics or formal criteria, aesthetic criteria?
They do not. It's simply too prone to bias. There's no way for me to divide my subjectivity or somebody else's subjectivity outside of that. Others have tried, so, and more power to them to do so. But those kind of, you know, landscape amenity-based scales are so easily hijacked by cultural history or personal history.
How do you begin to measure these things in a landscape that has a rich cultural and spatial and formal history? How do you apply this meta study when you're confronted with issues that are very much based on form and based on aesthetics and based on beauty, which are less statistical or analytically resolved but identified? Is this method applicable on cultural landscapes?
I certainly wouldn't apply it there, because I'm not sure we have the right to determine for a local populace like what they should be looking at or not looking at. And to say, tell them based on our analytical model that, well, it turns out they like trees more than rocks. I don't see
how would you handle a client who were to give you a rather rich cultural landscape and ask you to determine where the referential zones of that landscape are and how they should go about exaggerating them or preserving them or developing around them?
I would probably attach the meta landscape forces to some of those criteria, meaning, let's say you can imagine a scenario where climate change implies a much drier climate over the next 20 to 50 years. I would say, well, unless you begin importing water, then you're going to have less of your lakes. You can determine whether you like more lake or less lake or deeper lake or shallower lake, but I will determine whether you can have more or less and what that implies about what you're going to import and export. So I think that they can always interact in such interesting and complex ways.
So beauty is certainly not a topic.
It's not a sensible topic. By all means, we all...
Is it important?
Absolutely, it's important.
Why?
It's important, if nothing else, to attract people to projects so that they will invest in it. Not necessarily monetarily, but invest in the long-term reality of a project, the long-term implementation of a kind of changing system. My mappings are certainly meant to draw you in various ways, as well as the photography we do.
But your work has a quality of beauty embedded within it and a quality of craft.
Exactly.
How do you wrestle with this internal contradiction between your ultimate goal mm-hmm. and some of the tools that you're using?
Well, that's what's interesting is I simply don't find the contradiction. I find the beauty and the aesthetic quality to emerge out of the complexity that I research, study, and attempt to represent. When I do that, that kind of lifelike complexity quality comes out fairly naturally without extensive editing on my part.
How is PREX driven as an organization, and how are the clients not drawn to you, but where? Give us an example of some of your other clients and what kind of projects that you've been asked to work on in the past couple of years you've been there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alan, of course, as a very innovative and very creative landscape thinker, as well as simply a kind of outside of the box, very marginal, liminal idea maker, has interacted and developed relationships in places that. Landscape architects and designers in general rarely go. He simply began photographing the condition of the mining landscape and developed a relationship with the EPA, who of course has interest in these landscapes because they control the water and the air that can be contaminated by mining landscapes. And so we are brought in as a way to create a model for communities that live with or near or in the effects of a mined landscape that could be propagated across the nation. There's 500,000 abandoned mines. So there are extensive opportunities to interact with this condition. And the EPA is a type of client that is very interested in it and also not quite equipped to handle the need to visualize change for a community, for example. Or also the need to see the interaction between the economics, the ecology, and the design elements that people will be interacting with the actual landscape. So EPA is a great example. There are individual cities that come to us that have an intractable problem, like Cleveland and its declining population. And just to give a fresh eye to it, a fresh systemic view of, okay, so you have lots of little sites, but let's not look at them as little sites. What do they look like as a family? What do they look like as a pattern and a collective unit? And you see a different set of relationships, and then we both, either in written report or through meetings and through mappings, sort of reveal these relationships for them that they can then more productively integrate that land back into their city. So there's two examples, governmental agencies, cities. And then private corporations, of course.
What kind of client would be an ideal client? Who would you pick if you could handpick your next client project and project type?
I would certainly pick the Department of Defense, easily. Both because of their vast resources, sure, that's great. But more importantly, their vast ability to implement change so quickly. They have a command structure in place to do so. It's a matter of a simple command at the highest level, and it propagates very quickly. And I also give them credit for being very forward-thinking, because naturally, military is a kind of like a massive cultural probe that kind of pushes us beyond where we're at always. Right? Most of our technologies are dual use from military. GIS, the internet itself, satellite systems. Most of what we know about the environment is derived from war. You know, once we began using nuclear bombs, we had to get a handle on what kind of effects they would produce at such a scale. That was the start of kind of ecosystem theory and really sort of measuring environmental services and environmental change on a large climate scale, all developed through war. So the Department of Defense is always pushing. Their supply lines are one of their most attacked units in the kind of military apparatus. So what do they want to do? They want to get the supply lines to be off the grid. They would love to generate all their energy renewably. And so they're pushing forward on solar cities and solar camps and solar bases, all that I'm sure will eventually create the technology that we as a society benefit from. So the Department of Defense can achieve these goals, and they're already at the forefront of many of these edges in terms of bodily ability, you know, the ability of a soldier to deal with extreme measures, the use of animals, the use of dogs to detect bombs. I mean, these are amazing hybrid relationships between humans and the landscape that we occupy. And there are, of course, disastrous consequences of war, no doubt. But I have not read or heard of an animal population or living population that does not consume and fight for resources with everything around them.
What catalyzed your interest in the defense as a mechanism to manipulate the landscape?
Several things. First, my father was in Vietnam, and he talks so eloquently and complexly about how the Army trained them, how the Army achieves goals sort of outside the realm of regular society, how they get men to go beyond sort of standard abilities, both physically, mentally, emotionally. Also, the complex set of background operations, like it takes five men in the background to put one man in the field in terms of infrastructure, the movement of infrastructure. Just, he learned extensive amounts. He got a great education, as good as my Harvard education easily, simply through his service in the military. So that's the original spark. And then on top of that, in my intellectual adventures into the roots of all these problems that I encounter, like that I feel like people are, they're sort of looking at the surface expression of a problem, whether it be environmental issues or economic issues. And I try to delve down to the bottom of, like, where is this stemming from? And each time I go, it inevitably travels through war and technologies based for war and defense operations.
Let's come back to Rove.
All right.
You're looking into this notion of speculation, land speculation as a driver of landscape evolution. And you have three questions. Is the primary object the land itself? Are humans acting instinctually via a herd-like behavior? And did speculation, the behavior of, arrive in the Roman times? You've been here for 7 or 8 months. What are your thoughts regarding that? And give us a couple examples.
Well, it's been a great adventure. First of all, I began doing a mapping, and it truly did educate myself and reveal a set of conditions that I'm fascinated by. It's a mapping that shows, that identifies all the speculative bubbles that are well documented that crashed an economic or even a national political system. There are 47 bubbles, speculative bubbles, from the 1600s till now. That's essentially, the 1600s are interesting because the economic systems became sophisticated enough to handle international trade, etc. So it's no surprise that speculative bubbles became more common then. Also, we're limited by our documentation. Of course, printing started in that time as well, and so we have much more documentation since 1600s. There's 47 over 400 years. That's over one every 10 years. So this is a repetitive behavior, okay? Also, these are across various cultures. So it's not limited to Anglo-Saxons, which is often posited by various theorists, that's an Anglo-Saxon sickness, this ability to speculate on economic assets. So that's the first note. It's just simply the repetitive nature of the behavior. Second is the way it kind of ebbs and flows, the really big, nasty speculative bubbles, such as the Great Depression, let's say, in the United States, but also globally. There's a little gap. There's a gap of quite a few years before you have another speculative bubble after the Great Depression, because people learned that this behavior and they got stung by it, right? Some became poor, some reduced their wealth, but everyone was affected and feared it. But this is a great statistical effect. It's called the recency effect. You remember what happened not too long ago, and you learned that lesson, but once the generation passes, it's tough to remember it anymore, and you begin to build another bubble. So there's the second idea, is that it's definitely ebbs and flows. It related to some interesting psychological issues, some cognitive biases we have that are studied by, you know, different fields such as psychology or behavioral economics. Lastly, it continues on. Currently, right now, there are several bubbles developing, one in China. There are vast cities being built in China for 1 million-plus inhabitants that have no residents currently, simply because housing and land is always considered a great holder of value. So many people in China, instead of putting their money in banks, which can't even keep up with inflation, put it in residences and land, new landscape. So those landscapes are being built simply because of this investment idea. Nobody's living in them. Nobody needs them currently. So there's a new bubble developing right now, and in a whole other culture, that's China. And so I began to try to understand, well, there's so many that happened over these past 400 years, but where did it really start? And it turns out that the last time that economic systems were truly sophisticated on a kind of international, continental, you know, large scale was the Roman economy. And there's a great indicator of it. We've analyzed soil in Greenland to determine the kind of lead content, because lead is normally volatilized by the minting of currency, so as we melt down and smelt metal to create coinage. The levels of lead spike significantly in the both Republican and Imperial Age, so roughly 200 BC to 200 or 300 AD. It does not reach the levels of lead of those years, the Imperial Roman Age, until the 1600s, until just before the Industrial Revolution. So there is even a kind of valid numeric measurement of this, that the economy was that large then. It was monetized, meaning that there was a common currency used throughout the Roman Empire, which would allow, at least in some protean form, the ability to trade on assumed value of an asset like landscape. Villas were the primary holder of that value. Now, villas, we assume today, are talking about country homes or some sort of wealthy house. But in Roman times, these would have absolutely been talking about farms, complexes that produced value. It was an agrarian economy, so the most valuable commodities would have come off the land and from the water. And it turns out the villas extensively occupied the central Roman landscape, as well as all the way to the edge of the empire in Britain, as well as in Egypt, etc., etc. The entire empire was covered with villas that may have been the most powerful unit of the economy. We have fish ponds where they grew fish that are of such extensive size. We know they're bigger, they're more production than simply for a single villa. They were for export. So because these are holders of value, economic value, in the aquacultural and agricultural commodity arena, we know that they can be bought and sold based on those values. The question is, did they become overbuilt, much like we do today? It's very difficult to ascertain whether that happened or not. But what we do have is a very interesting peak and decline in the second century. And it turns out that that's a time when taxes were extensively repealed, which would have produced an amount of sort of easy cash, easy credit to build more and more villas. And it's a time of great building boom. We have lots of inscription from there. We know lots of villas were occupied at the most extensive amount at that period. And just after it, it declines. The number of villas being occupied declines, as well as there's various economic kind of pushes by the imperial government to kind of help people. So it seems like it was a time of crisis. And it's largely known in the Roman literature as the third century crisis. No one knows why it happened, but it may be that they overbuilt. They had too much capacity. And once plagues hit, military instability came, the value of that landscape that was assumed to be so high suddenly dropped because it couldn't be supported. The population dropped, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's circumstantial, but there's some good evidence that at least they invested in their landscape and they used villas as a vehicle of investment, maybe the first vehicle of investment. And that's what fascinates me, because I also studied the kind of etymology of the word villa, and it turns out, as shockingly as it sounds, that economy and villa derive from the same Proto-Indo-European root, because it's about, economy is about household management originally, the value of the house, the value of the lands associated with the house. And villa, of course, is the home unit, the production unit. And so these two were linked from the very beginning. They are the source of the same concept of value. It seems that across these 47 bubbles in modern times, 49 if you include the two in the Roman times that I think I've identified, across 90% of those, land and banks were involved in speculation. So land is a holder of value and is essentially created and altered through economic speculation.
What do the examples that you've looked at here represent, or what typologies of agricultural villas do they represent?
Well, there's this very strong division in literature between several. There's the villa urbana, which is considered the luxurious residence of the dominus, or the owner of the villa, of the property. Sadly, that's where all the scholarship attention has been over the years, because we're focused on these cultural and aesthetic qualities that sometimes confuse us as to what the underlying causes are. But in those times, as important would have been the villa rustica, which is more the farming apparatus, the farming outbuildings, possibly where slaves would have lived, or even just workers in general, as well as a concept called villa maritima, which are the maritime villas, which would have both farmed certain crops as well as used fish ponds to grow aquacultural species. And so these divisions are somewhat artificial, but they are talked about in the ancient Roman literature, so they are real in some sense. People have even valued them and suggested that the villa maritima was very profitable, and that's a highly valued asset. And these are Romans speaking. Whereas the villa rustica, also highly valuable, but the villa urbana is not necessarily profitable, only if you could sell it to some schmo that didn't know the value.
Where are you taking this project after the summer?
After the summer, I'm attempting to now connect this behavior that I've documented across time that has a very clear pattern of easy credit, increased value, shock to the system, and crash that hurts both the environment, the economy, as well as the political stability of a nation. I've seen this pattern. And now I want to see if that behavior is actually part of a larger macro behavior that we all living organisms participate in, which is herding, swarming, flocking. It's a well-known behavior. We understand it so little, but it's so enticing because it's made up of small rational behavioral traits that create an irrational effect. if it's true that that's a behavior that's deeply embedded, it's a natural predisposition we have, then all the politics, regulation, and enforcement we throw at it won't change it.
Where are you going to study it?
I will be working at MIT with P-RECs, but traveling around on my own as well to study it myself, to the nether regions where these strange behaviors apply.
Great. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Case, it's been great having you in Terragrams, and good luck with the evolution of your project.
It's a pleasure, Craig, and thank you very much.
You are listening to Terragrams, and in this dispatch we were joined by Casey Brown, assistant professor of landscape architecture at Clemson University, principal researcher with P-RECs, and the 2010-2011 recipient of the American Academy Room Prize in Landscape Architecture. Thank you for joining us for the 31st Dispatch of Terragrams. Terragrams must rely exclusively on contributions from listeners like you. Your support will ensure that you, your colleagues, studio, faculty body, students, and classmates can continue to benefit from our growing and open archive as well as all our forthcoming discussions. If you've enjoyed the Terragrams initiative and are looking forward to our upcoming dispatches, go to our homepage at terragrams.com and select Donate. This will lead you to the PayPal site for an online contribution. Otherwise, please contact me directly at info@terragrams.com for alternate forms or methods of support. All donations count. Please help. To find out more about Terragrams and sign up for our next delivery, please visit our website or subscribe to us using iTunes. Thanks to Peter Melandra for his help in research and dispatch preparation. Special thanks also to the books for the wonderful and very cool music. You can expose yourself more to the books at thebooksmusic.com. Check out their latest album, The Way Out. Join us soon for a conversation with Dutch landscape architect Dirk Simons. This concludes our 31st Dispatch of Terragrams. Thank you for listening.
Tammy and Brad.
Rainbow. All the music is a rainbow.